7 billion people on the planet, and at least among the famous, we know of only one named Swoosie. That would be Swoosie Kurtz, an actor known for her work on stage, in movies, and on TV. She's the author, with an assist from Joni Rogers, of a memoir now out in paperback called Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Swoosie Kurtz has a name and a face you do not soon forget. She's the winner of Tony, Emmy, Obie for Off-Broadway, and Drama Desk Awards. The list of plays she's been in runs into the dozens. Her frequent film work includes Liar, Liar, and Citizen Ruth, among many others. Her TV work includes roles on Sisters, Love, Sydney, Pushing Daisies, and currently the sitcom Mike and Molly. Swoosie Kurtz, we're very proud to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, well, Jeffrey, thank you for that wonderful introduction. I don't know if I can live up to it. I'm 1 in 7 billion?
Yes. Well, we don't have any other Swoosies, but we also haven't checked the phone book yet. But, you know, who knows? There could be a few others out there. There must have been some people named after you by now, I'm thinking.
Well, you know, the only one I know of is Ashley Judd named her horse after me. Which I take as an honor, I guess, you know.
It's funny because we had a conversation yesterday about Waterloo, and there was a quote by Lord Wellington mentioned, the Duke of Wellington, where he said, you know, just because I was born in Ireland doesn't make me Irish. If I was born in a stable, that wouldn't make me a horse.
Oh, that's so good.
We're talking about horses being named after people. So honestly, you were named after a plane, it sounds like, right?
I was. I was named after a B-17 that my father flew in the war. And he was the most decorated Air Force pilot of World War II. So he flew a lot of missions in this plane that was called the Swoosie, because there was a popular song out at the time about a strange-looking sort of hybrid bird that looked like it was part swan, part goose. And they named it Swoosie. And the plane was made up of original parts and then parts that were kind of cobbled together from other planes that had been, you know, destroyed or damaged in some way. So my parents thought this was an appropriate name for a baby.
Did you ever have moments in your childhood when you said, come on, couldn't I just have been, you know, Jane or something?
Oh, I desperately wanted to be Jane, Mary, Sue, you know, and plus, I mean, I was an only child and I went to a lot of different schools because my dad, you know, we moved around in the Air Force. And, I remember, you know, being made fun of and everything for my name and the kids, you know, kids can be very rough. And a teacher once, I was new, of course, in the middle of the school year, and she said, stand up, dear, tell us what your name is. And, of course, I was just shaking and terrified. And I stood up and went, Swoosie. And she said, are you sure, dear? And, you know, for a millisecond, I wasn't. I thought, maybe I've got this wrong.
God, terrifying teachers can kind of scare that out of you, though, can't they?
Terrifying when you're little. Oh, I know.
Wow. So you've been a public figure since day one. I mean, was it because your father was such a decorated pilot that the picture of your first day on Earth was in the newspapers?
Yes, that was part of it. He was also on 3 Olympic diving teams, so that fed into it. And my mother was an author. She wrote this beautiful book when she was pregnant with me called My Rival, the Sky, which I have threaded throughout my book and woven into each chapter. It's an amazing book.
That really is a wonderful title too, My Rival, the Sky.
She felt that that was her, my father's mistress was the sky. She was always losing him to going up in a plane or going up on the high platform to dive.
And in fact, your dad was away when you were born. How long until he found out that you had been born?
I think it was a few days. And then my mother's telegram that she had sent, you know, everything took ages back then to get through, and it had to get through the censors and all that during the war. And he was off in combat, and it just said, Swoosie, 6 pounds, 8 ounces, or whatever I was. And it didn't say whether I was a boy or a girl, so he had to wait a few more days to find that out.
I love the way you take note of the economy of her writing, though, that you even had fewer letters available to you with Western Union or RCA radiogram than you had with tweets today.
With Twitter and everything, exactly. But she still managed to put in, what was that phrase? She still managed to put in, my love always or something. She still
above all else, yeah, yeah.
Above all else, that was it. That
phrase. That is wonderful stuff. So, now your mom was a pilot too, is that right?
My dad, I mean, when they were dating, my dad taught my mom to fly. Took her up in this little single engine open cockpit thing and taught her to fly. and she soloed. So, you know, she didn't continue with it, but pretty amazing.
Well, that was something. So she was really ahead of her time in a lot of ways. I mean, doing things that women didn't do much of at the time.
She was very much ahead of her time, mm-hmm. in so many ways. And they tried very hard to get pregnant. And, you know, that was back in the day when, well, you just didn't, you said, okay, I guess we're not going to have kids, or you adopted. And but she went to a few doctors and, you know, finally found one who could do some things that would make her fertile, you know, and then they got me. So it was like I was very much a wanted child, which is kind of one of the messages in my book. Not meaning to be a message, but just I kind of wanted to tell people about this incredible, rather charmed, loving childhood that I had, because I know so many people don't have that experience. And we've heard a lot of those stories. And I thought it might just be refreshing to hear about somebody who actually had a terrific childhood with two amazing people as parents.
Well, they really do sound like incredibly positive people. How did they get there? I mean, it was not through the same pathway, I gather.
Mm-mm. My father had a horrible childhood. He ran away from home when he was 12. He had these abusive stepfathers and just a very kind of cold, repressed mother. And, you know, he just followed his dreams. He wanted to be a diver. And he hitchhiked across the country and found this great coach in Los Angeles and went from there. He was just one of those people who made the impossible possible. He was an amazing overachiever. And given this awful childhood that he had with really very little love and care, he turned out to be this incredibly loving parent and husband and person, you know, which is a great tribute to him. Because other people who have had that, you know, can wind up in the penitentiary.
They really can. So it's quite a testament to him. The book is called Part Swan, Part Goose, An Uncommon Memoir of Womanhood, Work, and Family. Swoosie Kurtz wrote it. It's now out in paperback. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Swoosie Kurtz and you in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Swoosie Kurtz. Yes, the Swoosie Kurtz. Is there more than one? Swoosie Kurtz is the author with Joni Rogers of a book called Part Swan, Part Goose, An Uncommon Memoir of Womanhood, Work, and Family. We have not yet gotten to talk about her acting career. We're still talking about how she got her name and her parents and all that. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region and by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we talked about how your father was able to overcome adversity, a very positive person. Your mother sounds like she had a much more gentle upbringing.
Much more gentle. In Omaha, Nebraska, her parents were just, you know, salt of the earth people, wonderful, wonderful, loving people. She was one of five children. And I don't know, you know, you don't know nature or nurture. She just has always had this upbeat nature, and she's a real people person. And she's about to turn 100. She lives with me, my choice.
I thought I read that she was 99. Okay, she's getting close to her 100th birthday this year.
She's right.
Wow.
And she just, her doctor asked her a couple of years ago, Margo, what is your secret? And she said, I love life. And she's always said that. And she just makes the best of everything. And so the two of them together, my father was more of a darker nature, not as outgoing as she, but they made a terrific team because he was a real achiever and he would move ahead, you know, get things done. And meanwhile, she would sort of stroll as we were walking and look at, you know, get to know people along the way in life.
I love that detail about the walking pace differences. He would just charge ahead. She'd stop and smell every rose and talk to every person.
Exactly. And I inherited his where's the fire gait. People always think I'm going someplace terribly important because I walk so fast with a purpose.
Now, you were able to link her book, which we talked about, My Rival, the Sky, to the release of yours in its hardback edition. Tell us that story.
Yes, that was my original dream, Jeffrey, was to get her book re-released to this generation, which unfortunately still has, you know, loved ones across the world fighting a war. And I just reread it when we went to war with Iraq so many years ago, and I just thought, wow, this just could have been written yesterday afternoon, because the feeling, you know, they didn't have Skype or cell phones or all that, but the human feelings don't change. And I just think it's a beautiful book, and there are so many wonderful, inspirational kind of life messages in there. And my dream came true of not only my book, but her book being released at the same time. It's just as an e-book, but, you know, people can get it. And then it's woven throughout my book, so it's there.
Yeah, the excerpts really help flesh out a bit about her and her amazing patience. I mean, I just can't imagine what it must have been like. And, you know, again, in this world that we live in with all the instant communications, the idea of waiting days, weeks, sometimes months to hear from somebody you love deeply, to know that they're alive.
I mean, yes, and meanwhile, not knowing, she didn't know if he was missing, prisoner of war, dead, you know, for weeks on end, and then something would finally come through, and it would be all, a lot of it would be blacked out, you know, by the censors and everything, but they held on to those. Her letters were, you know, precious, and she still would talk about those, and him getting letters from her.
So you mentioned already that you moved around a lot, so asking where you grew up sounds like it's a question with many answers.
Yes. How long do you have?
A few minutes left. But I mean, what are the places that really stand out before you got to Hollywood?
We hit all the... friends of mine went to, you know, their fathers were stationed in Paris and Morocco and all the exotic places. And we sort of went to Muskoka, Illinois, and Tampa, and Wichita, and San Antonio, and all of which were great fun. And I really got to know this country, which I'm grateful for as a kid, you know, because we were constantly driving back and forth to some new place. But I think my grandmother's house in Omaha was my real, if I had any continuity at all, that was it. But it was actually great training. It was the best boot camp in the world for this life as an actor, because you're really such a gypsy.
Moving from place to place, you got used to that, sure, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, being dropped into a group of strangers and then being plucked out and then being dropped into another room full of strangers.
There are plenty of pictures in the book, and it was just about the time I was starting to wonder at what age you began performing. I turned the page, and there was the picture of you and your dad on a diving board, and you were, what, 3 years old?
Yes. That was my first aquacade with my dad. We would do those sometimes just for fun. And, then I wanted to be a ballerina, and I spent several years really convinced that I was destined to be a prima ballerina. And I was good at it. I had good line, and I adapted to it well. But then I got toward high school, and the bug hit me, the acting bug. And I did a scene in high school drama class, and that was it. I boom, you know, Eureka in the bathtub. I had found my identity, and then I couldn't. Everything else fell away, and I couldn't think about anything else.
Now, I'm trying to figure out the timeline here. You mentioned seeing some plays on Broadway pretty early in life. Had you seen those before you were in a play yourself, or was it?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. My mom would bring me to New York when I was like eight, starting when I was eight, maybe once a year or something, eight, nine, 10, 11, and take me to shows. And, you know, that kind of did it. I was hooked.
And so your parents did finally pick a place to settle, so you could go to high school in one place. And why that particular high school? It was a choice of North Hollywood versus Hollywood High, right? And you chose Hollywood High?
Right. I chose Hollywood High because I had heard that there was this legendary drama teacher, John Engel, who taught at Hollywood High. And he had all these famous graduates, and he was just supposed to be incredible. But technically, I was supposed to go to North Hollywood High. My dad had actually been at Hollywood High. So he went in and talked to the principal and, of course, once again made the impossible possible. He got me in. He got me into Mr. Engel's class, which was so booked, you know, it was like someone had to die to get, you know, to get in. And he got me in. And so John Engel, who subsequently, by the way, was on General Hospital, became quite famous. He really lit the fire for me. You know, he was just a great man of the theater and taught me about stage presence and energy on stage. And so that's really where, that was it. That's all I wanted to do.
I just love this part, though, where you talk about some of the things you did with the drama program at Hollywood High. You mentioned you can play the hell out of a cancer patient, a mental patient, and a hooker.
Yes, that's true today. Anyone, you know, and they say, oh, we've got to cast this part, this woman who had shock treatments. Oh, get swoosy. That's what I always think.
There's another reference in here, though, to something about a reference to we need a swoosy Kurtz type person to play this part, but you didn't get cast for it. Did that really happen?
Oh, I swear to God, it actually happened. It was the director, Louis Malle, and they send out a breakdown to the agents and managers, and it'll say the name of the part, and it'll describe the role. And this was a swoosy Kurtz type. And so, well, my agent and I thought, well, my God, I'm in. When's my appointment? And so he sent me in, and we had a nice talk, and I came out. My agent called me and said, he doesn't think you're right. It's just amazing, this business.
Hi, I'm Swoosy Kurtz, and I can't get a part playing a Swoosy Kurtz-type role.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Swoosy Kurtz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the author with Joni Rogers of Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Your first TV gig was while you were still at Hollywood High. Is that right, Swoosy?
Yes. It was very exciting at the time. I got a role on The Donna Reed Show, which was a big deal. I worked one day and got my SAG card. So I came back, you know, the next day feeling like a big woman on campus. And, you know, people would say, oh, there was a history test yesterday. And I go, oh, really? I wouldn't know. I was filming. You know, it was very impressive. I was very full of myself. And then, of course, when it came to broadcast, we lined up the relatives across the country, alerted everybody, watch, you know, tonight. Because, of course, there was no VCR back then. And everybody watched. And I was basically pretty much cut out.
Oh, not there at all.
There was my voice over talking on the phone to Shelley Fabre, and then a quick flick, you know, quick, very brief appearance of someone who might have been me in a party scene. So that was one of my first lessons in showbiz. Don't count your chickens. You might end up on the cutting room floor.
Right. So the process of acting, your mom talks about action over inhibition. You say that you learned that from your mom, and I wonder how well that has served you as an actor to just go in there and do something without feeling like, oh, I don't know if I should do this.
Just commit to it. I think that has fed a lot into it. I think from both my mom and my dad, it's just, you know, go for it. Give them what they need. Show them what you can do. If it doesn't work out, you know, you're not in control of that. But if you gave it your best shot, then you can walk away going, well, whatever the outcome, I controlled the part of it I could control.
And how meticulous is your preparation? I mean, you're a bit of a perfectionist as a performer.
Oh, yeah. I'm afraid I am in everything in life. I probably over-prepare. I really think I over-prepare. But, it works for me in many ways, too. I am, right down to the last detail. I mean, I drive directors crazy. I mean, they ultimately love me for it, but it's kind of like, oh, so it's not another question. Because I'm constantly saying, no, but what about? And not in a silly way. I mean, I honestly have to tell you, a lot of actors ask a lot of unnecessary questions. And what you were just saying, Jeffrey, about just go ahead and do it, you know, find out what happens, commit to it, is good in so many cases. I think a lot of actors, but I don't know, the some of the questions I ask, I just need to say it out loud. Do you know what I mean? And then it's like it's covered in my brain.
So you've at least got the notion out there, the concept.
I got it out there, mm-hmm. And I bounced it off the director, and we said, oh, well, that's not important, or, oh, yeah, good point. She does refer back to that in Act One or whatever. You know, so it gives me a little something to hang something on. It gives me a little landmark.
You mentioned driving directors crazy, but I have to believe that as much as you've worked, you are probably a bit of a director's dream. I mean, you must take direction well anyway.
You know something? I really do, and I don't mean to brag in that way, but I really do take direction really well. I mean, I feel that I can get something out of a director who isn't maybe the strongest director or the best director in the world, but I can get something out of them that will help me, that I can apply right away. I do, and I think that comes from my dad. He took direction very well. People coaching him in diving and flying, and he was, I think I got that from him.
He worked with Johnny Weissmuller in his diving days, didn't he? The guy who wanted to play Tarzan?
He did. They were buddies, yeah. Mm-hmm. He knew so many amazing people.
And so you mentioned as you were growing up that you were sort of like a miniature adult in a way. Was that just because there were no siblings around to be kids with?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. And I think the other factor was because we were moving all the time and, you know, not all the time, but often, two or three times a year sometimes. And I was very shy, you know, like a lot of actors. I'm an extrovert on stage or in front of a camera, but an introvert in life. And this shyness was compounded by the fact I was an only child, and we were moving around so much. And I was always the new kid in school, it seemed like. And so I think what it did was throw me back on my parents as my best friends, because I was a little bit scared of the outside world, which I still am. And so I was like, oh, they're my comfort zone. You know, they're my two pals. So we really became very, very close, and they just understood everything. I mean, it was like three adults hanging out together, and they would always respect my opinion, even when I was little, like, what motel do you think we should stop at tonight on our road trip to our new place?
Mm-hmm. And well, you could have turned out to be an awful princess, but it doesn't seem like you did.
No, not at all. But it was strange. It was a very unique growing up. My therapist that I sometimes talk to, but sometimes I can't reach her, she said to me something pretty shocking. She said, Susie, I think the only thing missing from your childhood was a child, which was a pretty astonishing statement, and I think she might be right. But all I know is, whatever it was heaven.
Mm-hmm. It certainly worked for you. You do get around to your romantic life in the book. As you point out, there's no bombshell, there's no coming out or anything like that. But why, then, have you never settled down?
I was going to say, if we're going to talk about my romantic life, that won't take very long.
It's just two pages here in the book.
Yeah, exactly. That's about right. Marriage was not sort of on my radar. I had blinders on about my career. It was just like, I was so passionate about it. I wanted it so much. And I didn't really, it was like, oh, well, yeah, I kind of put that off to the side. And I sort of feel like, as I say in the book, if you have to put get married on a list, you know, along with pick up dry cleaning, have children, whatever, it's sort of not really doing justice to the person you're going to marry. I knew that I never really wanted to have children. I just knew that was not something that I was passionate about. I love children, but I just, you know, just not. I knew when I was little, I didn't want to choose that as part of my life. And getting married thing, you know, I'm still hoping that I'll meet some great guy. I don't think it's too late, but I'm not actively looking. You know, it's not something that I really focus on. I think my parents have taken such a place in my life of love, and I still have my mom, kind of, you know, she's still there a lot of the time.
Right.
And
in fact, you used your parents' house as your West Coast place to be right up until the time your mom moved in with you, didn't you?
I did for years because it was so great. They lived out there, really, you know, close to most of the studios. And so I was based in New York for most of my adult life, and I mean, still am, really, in my apartment there now. And you know, when I would get a job out there that would be, you know, 2 weeks or 2 months long or whatever, I would go out and stay with them. It was so great. And I actually stayed with them for the entire run of Sisters, which was almost 6 years. I stayed with them. I don't know why I never got my own place. It was just, it was so convenient. It was 4 minutes from Warner Brothers, and they sort of, you know, took care of me. They got groceries in and put gas in the car, and I had these 17-hour days, and it was just fabulous.
It's a place to go. So I was just trying to figure out, as I look at the incredibly long list of stuff you've done, what's the longest you've ever not worked?
Oh, well, I don't, you know, there are men named Anytime. I mean, there were whole years or year and a half stretches where, you know, the tide was out. It was very, very quiet. And, of course, as an actor, you think, I will never work again. This is it. You really believe that. And there were some years in there that, I mean, stuff I had done like the year before would come out, would be released or something. So it kind of looked like I was still around. But I knew the truth, which was, hey, I haven't done anything in a year and a half, you know.
Well,
but it looks, everybody thinks I work all the time, so I shouldn't try to, you know, destroy that image.
It's a good image to have as an actor. Swoosie Kurtz is our guest. Her book is part Swan, part Goose. We'll come back and talk more with Swoosie and take some phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our conversation this hour is with Swoosie Kurtz, the actor who has been in so much stuff on stage, on film, in Sisters, in Pushing Daisies, and currently in Mike and Molly. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Swoosie about her memoir, written with Joni Rogers, now out in paperback, called Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Phone number here on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'm struck by a couple of quotes that just jump out of this book, and one of them is, I love myself more at work than I do at home.
Well, my theory is that when people are lucky enough, like me, to do what they love, or even not, even if I just think that the structure of working and the focus brings out the best in all of us, and I think we're really at our best when we're working. And then, you know, when you kind of go home, it's like, oh, everything kind of falls apart and you let down, which is great. You should unplug and rest. But I'm just more scattered in life. When I have a focus of, you know, rehearsal or filming, whatever, it just definitely, I know for myself, it brings out the best in me, my higher self, my more really laser-focused self.
It reminds me of what David Barry said once about the workplace. It's a romantic place because everybody's dressed up and at their best. At home, people have toothpaste stains on their bathrobes.
Oh, see, that's so true.
It is, you are slovenly selves at home, but yeah, at work we are at our best. I see your point there.
We really are. We pull it together and we go for a purpose larger than ourselves. You know, everybody's there to do a purpose that is not really about them. It's for a higher thing. So I love it.
A couple of calls here. Let's go to John and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Swoosie Kurtz.
You uttered something, a phrase a bit ago that may be a little out of context now, but you said you have to go for it. You know, give them your best shot when you're doing something, whether it's in performance, but I think it might go to other, you know, venues in our lives too. But sometimes, don't you have to give them what they want or what you think they want before you can get in the position? And so my question is, how often do you pander to the poor taste of the director in order to get into the position so that you can then show the director what would probably be a better way to portray the character or something.
Okay.
Well, you brought up a very good point. That's very, very tricky, and it's so true. I mean, especially when you're starting out, I can only speak for being an actor, but, you know, some of this. I mean, I did extra work. I auditioned for the role of a corpse and was told that they wanted someone less animated. So I wouldn't say I pander, but there's stuff that you do have to do to then get up on that next rung you're talking about where you can say, no, I'm actually not going to do that. Because as an actor, you have really very little control of anything. I mean, the only control you have is saying yes or no. I don't know. I will always listen to a director. Even if I think it's wrong, I'll try it. But I don't know. I think you have to judge each case as it comes up. There are times you'll have to do stuff that you don't believe is right or you don't believe in. So that's kind of life.
Let's take another call. Here's Lawrence and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Swoosie Kurtz.
Hi. I respect Swoosie very much, and I really enjoyed reading the Sports Illustrated article on her father that recently came out. I wondered if you could encapsulize the difference between the overprojection that is necessary when you're acting on stage, the underprojection, especially in close-ups of films where raising an eyebrow can be the gesture that captivates people, and whether TV acting is kind of a middle ground between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good question about the differences there. Thanks for that, Lawrence.
Yeah, Lawrence, that's a really good question. Well, on stage, you know, if you're in a 900 or 1,000-seat house, or in the case of musicals, a 1,200-seat house, I mean, you look up there, and there is a second balcony, and those people deserve just as good a show as the people in the orchestra seats. So that's really hard. On stage, people are mic'd now. I mean, back in my day when I first, nobody was mic'd, you know, when I started out. But, you know, that's where Gypsy Rose Lee, sing out, Louise, sing out. You know, you got to reach everybody and give them all a good show. It's in film and television, the tricky thing is, the best thing to do before you do a take is you say to the DP, the director of photography, you say, what lens are we on? Is this down to my waist? Is this a close-up? Or is this a big wide shot of the whole room? So then you have a measuring stick by which, you know, oh, my God, they're just taking a picture of this whole room full of people. I mean, I could do anything, you know, they're not barely going to see me. Or is it a medium shot, like down to the waist? And then you can kind of judge accordingly how big or how small. And then, of course, like you're saying, the close-up, wow. I'm not sure I've ever mastered this whole thing, to tell you the truth.
Really?
I don't think I have. I'm pretty good at television. I can kind of understand film less so, because you just don't know, and you don't have that much control over your performance on stage. You know, the actor has such huge responsibility, and you have more control. You know, you decide where the audience looks, your voice, your body English, everything. But on film, it's so many other people have their hand in shaping your performance. So, honestly, I'm still working on it.
That's amazing, though, that you actually go to the extent of asking how big the shot is, what lens we on, that kind of thing.
I mean, I think most film actors do. They say, what are we doing now? You know, is this, yeah.
I remember reading once that it might have actually been Marlena Dietrich who was telling Jimmy Stewart, just look at me with one of the eyes, because that way the other one, you're turning more of your face to the camera.
That's so true, Jeffrey. Michael Caine talks about that in his book on acting. Yeah, when you're doing like an over the shoulder of the other actor, like the camera's behind their shoulder and the camera's on you, your side of, look at their eye that's closest, because they're like off camera, you know, they're standing next to the camera feeding you lines. Look at the eye that's closest to the camera, their eye, because otherwise you're looking too wide.
That was it, yeah. So the days, though, of an actor working on film or television, I mean, and I hear people talk about, wow, we actually shot 8 pages today, I mean, which sounds like glacial progress. I mean, are you still at 3 in the afternoon saying the same lines you said at 11:30 this morning?
Oh, my God, yes. Over and over and over. You know, the French word for rehearsal is repetition, and I'm telling you, that's all it is. Day, hour after hour, you're right. Because you can start, like, especially if you have several people in a scene, like, God forbid, a table scene, they're the worst, like a dinner party. Because, oh, my God, you have to say those lines so many times. And they go around and they do everybody's coverage. And, you know, then if they get to you last, you're like, oh, my God. Now the camera's on me. And it's, you know, midnight. And I've been saying this stuff since 6 o'clock this morning.
Oh, my God. Do you feel like a melting candle by that point in the day?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So you do, because you say it in rehearsal, then you say it in the wide shot, you know, many, many times, several takes, and then you do it for the closer shot, then you do it for the two shot, then you do it for the other actor's coverage when you're feeding them lines, then you do it for your coverage, and oh, my gosh. By the end of the day. I mean, that's the great thing about film and television is at the end of that day, you shred those scenes and we'll probably never have to do them again. The theater, of course, is more like being on a treadmill because you're doing the same exact thing 8 times a week.
Yeah, the 8 times a week part is the amazing part to me. Wow, with Mondays off, and that's it.
One day off, yeah, exactly. 3 matinees a week. I've always thought it's a little inhumane. I've always thought it was one performance too many. 7 is doable, you know.
Yeah, but 8 is...
But that's, I don't that's think they're going to change it.
Now, so you were actually at USC and then left, went to London to get the majority of your training. You point out it wasn't really Stanislavski method. What's the difference between what Stanislavski talked about and what you learned?
Well, I think Stanislavski's been misinterpreted, but the impression is that he wants you to think about when your dog was run over, when you saw your dog being run over at age 8 and get that sense memory going and dredge up the emotions from within that way. And I think there's absolute validity in that, and you have to use your own emotions and your own experience. To a certain extent, I think in rehearsal they're very, very helpful. Then when it comes to producing that 8 times a week, I think you have to turn to technique. You have to. I don't know how you can do that 8 times a week or for all of those takes we're talking about. You can use different things in your life, you know, so you don't get stale on the one thing, but you have to have technique. And I think that was one of the things in London, where I went to school, that the British are so great on. You know, they have terrific technique. And technique is not a dirty word, by the way. It's sort of become that, but it's really very, very, it fires off a lot of emotions. You can get to it. You can get to the emotional part through technique. So I think it's incredibly valuable.
So do the work on the outside, and it will produce the stuff on the inside?
Very often, yeah. I mean, one silly example, sometimes if you have a great costume designer, like in The World According to Garp, when Anne Roth put that outfit on me as the hooker, I was like, oh, I get it. The miniskirt and the lace-up boots and the standing on 8th Avenue. You know, I mean, you get into it. And so, you know, it's a combination of feeding a lot of things into the computer. But I think the technique really, really is valuable.
You write, Swoosie, that you learn something from every character you play. But are there some characters you were happy to leave behind?
I always love any character that I'm doing while I'm, you know, while I'm playing that woman. I've been sad to leave some behind. Some of them, you know, I mean, we've all done those jobs in life where, my heart isn't in it. You know, I've done a couple of pilots and stuff that, thank God, didn't get picked up. Not the way to go into a pilot, by the way, hoping it's not picked up. That were just jobs. You know, they were like, oh, well, I haven't done anything in a while. This would be nice to make a little money here in this Spartan time. And I did it, and I was like, There have been very, very few of those, I'm lucky to say, that I don't feel passionate about. There have been a lot that broke my heart because they didn't go on.
Which brings up the question for one of my favorite things you've done, which was Pushing Daisies, which was a real unique concept on ABC, had a great cast. You had songs with Kristen Chenoweth. How could you go wrong there? And it was doing really, really reasonably well in the ratings. And then the writer's strike came and stopped it for months and months.
Yes.
And when it came back, it was crippled and didn't go on. How sad were you to see that project go away?
Oh, my gosh. I thought that show was a work of art. I mean, people are constantly stopping me and saying, oh, my God, I love that show so much. Brilliant. This brilliant Brian Fuller, who created it. There's never been anything like it on television. And not only the writing, but the look of it, astonishing. And just these bizarre characters. I had my eye patch, you know. It was just, yeah, we were really heartbroken about that, because it did. The writer's strike just put, you know, struck us to our knees, and then it was too late in the season by the time it was over to you know, gear up to make two more episodes. It was too expensive. So they said, well, just wait till the fall. So we were off the air because they didn't do any summer reruns or anything. We were off the air for about 11 months and then just thrown back on the air, and that was it. Didn't do well, you know.
No, it really didn't. We have an email from Sue. She doesn't say where she's writing from. Swoosie is hilarious on Mike and Molly. Please tell her how much I appreciate always getting a laugh when I see her and know that I will sleep well that night as I got my dose of humor.
Oh, that's lovely. That's great.
Yeah, just before we go, because we're getting short on time here, your mom's still kind of hanging in there? She's got dementia, you point out in the book, but she's there sometimes and not sometimes.
Yeah, it's sort of pleasant dementia, and she has almost total short-term memory loss, which who among us doesn't? But she'll be 100 in September, and she still has that wonderful spirit in there somewhere, you know. And, you know, good days and bad days, but the last 8 years taking care of her was one reason I wanted to write this book, because I know that so many people are going through it now or about to go through it. And I wanted the book to kind of be a lighthouse of sorts for, you know, baby boomers going through it and to make people feel not so alone.
It's a really honest and frank book and a lot of fun to read as well. It's called Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Swoosie Kurtz, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. I've loved talking to you.